The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
The presidency and the pill, how Obama rules on contraceptive coverage captured the campaign. Santorum resurgent, Romney rebuked.
Cairo versus Washington, a year since U.S. support for democracy in Egypt, charges against U.S. democracy workers there, and what to do about Syria.
Relearning leadership, lessons from the former Girl Scouts CEO now helping other nonprofits, business, and government work for the common good.
Ain't We Got Fun, Broadway veteran Robert Creighton's new CD celebrates songs of stage, screen, and tough guy James Cagney.
Black Gold for Black History Month, remembering the first African-American to win the top Olympic medal.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of Gatewave Incorporated, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of February 12th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
Who were told you have a right to health care, but you will have the health care that we tell you you have to give your people, whether it is against the teachings of your church or not.
Think what that does to people in faiths that do not share those views. This is a violation of conscience. We must have a president who is willing to protect America's first right, our right to worship God according to the dictates of our own conscience.
These employers will not have to pay for or provide contraceptive services. But women who work at these institutions will have access to free contraceptive services, just like other women.
Rick Santorum had his own Super Tuesday last week, trouncing Mitt Romney in the GOP's Missouri primary, caucuses in Colorado and Minnesota, albeit no actual delegates were involved. But both men were united days later in joining fierce condemnation of new Obama health insurance rules that required religious-run institutions, universities, hospitals, charities, but not actual places of worship, to include free contraceptive care in the health insurance policies they offer employees, regardless of their faith or lack of it. The uproar led the president to speed a modification that would shift the requirement to insurance companies when employers have a conscientious objection.
The compromise did not immediately win approval from U.S. Catholic bishops and conservative opponents of intrusive government. And some observers thought Obama had created an unnecessary problem for his reelection campaign, just as an improving job picture may be limiting GOP attacks on his economic policy. But others saw a sly strategic win for the president, based on polling that shows majority support for his position, especially from women, especially younger women, and even Catholic women. For more on the pill, the presidency, and the new shape of the Republican campaign after Santorum's resurgence, for your ears only, we're joined again by Dr. Ron Fauché, president of the nonpartisan Claris Research Group and a veteran campaign handicapper. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Let's start back with the Tuesday voting. Was it a bigger setback for Romney, who retains great advantages in money and organization, or for Newt Gingrich, who's lost his position as the leading not-Romney?
Well, I think it was a setback for both of them, but I think what's really interesting is that it's given Rick Santorum an opportunity to surge nationally. You know, he did very well in the Iowa caucuses, but then never really sort of followed up with any big wins. But this gave him sort of the wind at his back that he needed nationally, and I think you'll see in the nationwide polling, Santorum will be clearly in a strong position. Some polling will probably show that he will pass by Mitt Romney, and Romney would be second, and Gingrich will be falling in third place.
Do you trace Santorum's triple header Tuesday more to his conservative constancy and campaigning, or to continuing doubts about Romney's principle, his high finance past, and his potential to confront Obama?
Well, I think a lot of it was about social conservatives who were sending a message that they don't think Mitt Romney has earned this nomination yet, and they're not about to hand it over to him yet. And they want to give Rick Santorum a shot at it. I also think that there has been a growing sense in the last couple of weeks that that Romney may have a tough time against Obama in November, which frees up some social conservatives to vote their heart and not vote electability.
Well, which GOP candidates do you now see strongest in some of the next upcoming nomination confrontations?
Romney still has to be handicapped as the favorite to win the nomination, but there's quite a few banana peels on that path. And I think we're going to see this week Santorum moving up in all the polls around the country. So that gives him an opportunity. That doesn't mean he's going to be able to take it, but it certainly gives him the opportunity. But if his campaign can raise money and build a national structure, then he very well could be positioned as the alternative to Romney and to go toe-to-toe with him.
How do you read the political fallout over religion and the pill last week, and the idea that Obama trapped Republicans into a social issue stand not as broadly popular as they supposed?
Well, you know, I think you're right. The polling shows that that the American people are at least fairly moderate or somewhat liberal on some of these issues. But I think on the other side of the coin, I think that President Obama, for the long term, hurt himself from the standpoint of this whole incident being a metaphor for overreaching government that's meddling in people's lives, and the idea of the administration taking the position that that they can tell people who they need to cover on health care and who they shouldn't, regardless of their conscience and religious beliefs, I think is a long-term problem for him.
And what about the energizing effect of the contraceptive issue, particularly on young people whose support was so critical to Obama's last election campaign? You published polling last week that showed registered voters, 18 to 29, already far more favorable to Democrats than Republicans, 56% to 45%.
Yeah, the voters that we polled for the Garfield Institute and Hiram College clearly showed that they see the Democrats on their side more than the Republicans on generational issues. And that's, I think, very encouraging for Democrats. So we saw younger voters vote in a big majority for Barack Obama last time. And even though that majority seems to have been knocked down a little bit, the Democrats still are on the plus side there by a wide margin. But I do think that this issue has also energized social conservatives around the country. And I think that's a big part of the surge that we, I think, are in the middle of seeing for Rick Santorum.
The president also shared some of the limelight for last week's $25 billion settlement by big banks with his Justice Department and state attorneys general on charges of mortgage improprieties. The money involved will benefit only about 1 million Americans facing foreclosure or who've already lost their homes, but could it mean more for Obama politically?
Well, it's possible. Anything that helps the home mortgage and the home economy right now is something that's important to many, many people, and it's the big drag really in the economy right now in a lot of ways. So it possibly can, but you know, the devil is always in the details, and in talking to voters, we've found that that a lot of voters are sort of waiting to see, you know, whether it applies to them, and if it does, how it applies to them. And so I think that's going to have to play out over time.
And what about the effect on Obama's Democratic base of his decision to forego principle and encourage donations to his super PAC to compete with the very well-funded Republican super PACs we've been seeing?
Well, I don't really think it's much of a surprise. You know, President Obama had, when he ran for president last time, said that he believed in the public financing system and would take public financing and limit his campaign spending. But after they saw they had an opportunity to raise a lot more money than public financing would give them, they dropped out of the public financing system and reversed the position. This is the same thing. We've been seeing politicians for years now advocating certain principles on campaign finance, but when the time came and when it's in their advantage not to follow those principles, they dropped them.
Dr. Ron Fauché is president of the nonpartisan Claris Research Group and a veteran campaign handicapper.
Quote from the news, "I don't want anyone to interpret the strong vote for it to be a seal of approval." That was House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi on lingering doubts despite the overwhelming 417-2 passage of an ethics bill banning insider trading by members of Congress. There were concerns about the free flow of information and the need to compromise with a stiffer Senate version.
Next, Cairo versus Washington and the challenge of Syria. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Alyssa Axelberth.
And I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Tell me why I should follow suit. That was India's Commerce Secretary Rahul Kular when questioned about sending a large trade delegation to Tehran despite Western calls for tightening economic sanctions against Iran's nuclear program as it moved towards weapon capability. Now this.
It's important to underscore these Americans have done absolutely nothing wrong. They do what American and international NGO workers do in various different parts of the world, which is to support democratic development and civil society.
I mean, this is a thin veneer of a legal investigation over what's really a political smear campaign.
It was a year ago this weekend that we brought you the cheers from Tahrir Square, as heard from the nearby apartment of an old college friend of mine who's lived and worked there for decades. We also heard warnings of pitfalls ahead from veteran Mideast negotiator Aaron David Miller, which have steadily come to pass. Islamist dominance in the emerging political process, longtime military leaders clinging to real power, the revival of Tahrir protests. Now there are charges against scores of NGO humanitarian aid and democracy workers, including 19 Americans, about which there were complaints last week by UN Ambassador Susan King and Charles Dunn of Freedom House, one of the NGOs involved.
With some of the Americans taking shelter at the American Embassy, including the son of U.S. Labor Secretary Ray LaHood, more than $1.3 billion in mostly military aid to Egypt hangs in the balance. Under U.S. law, the administration must certify that Egypt's new rulers are moving toward true democracy and civil liberties, unknown under 30 years of rule by Hosni Mubarak, ousted by the Tahrir protests and, ironically, pressure from Washington. For more on the situation in Egypt, on the escalating chaos in Libya since U.S. and NATO intervention there helped unseat Muammar Gaddafi, and on the debate over new intervention in bloody Syria, for your ears only, we're joined again by Arch Puddington, Vice President for Research at Freedom House. Welcome back to the program.
It's always a pleasure.
How many of your people are under threat of trial in Egypt, and how many of the Americans are actually still there?
Well, for Freedom House, we have no American staff in Egypt right now. There are six Egyptian staff who are under investigation and have been named as possible defendants by the authorities, and we have two who are in Washington right now. Both American citizens, one's an Egyptian-American, the other is Charles Dunn, the director of our Middle East program. So they've all been named, but we're mostly concerned about our six Egyptian colleagues who are in Cairo right now.
What were your people doing in Egypt, and what are the charges that officials there say are under investigation?
The Freedom House staff were there to build... build up civil society, to help organizations there do election monitoring, to help with issues related to freedom of expression, and just basically to help people outside the government build up some kind of organizational strength and ability to advocate for reform.
The Cairo government says it cannot interfere with the judicial authorities handling this case, but some underlying political agenda seems apparent. Maybe a way to blame outside agitation for the renewed protests that are actually sparked by continuing military control. What's your view of Cairo's motives?
I would say that this is entirely political and not legalistic at all. There are people who are holdovers from the Mubarak government who have never wanted NGOs to be able to really function in Egypt, and they are now using the uncertainty and chaos that's reigning in Egypt and the lack of a real governing authority to push to have NGOs basically neutered and made weak and impossible to function.
Given the key role Washington-Cairo relations have played in past Middle East politics, what impact do you see if the U.S. does cut off more than $1.3 billion in aid?
Well, I would hope that it doesn't get to that. I think that there are still all kinds of negotiations that are going on, and I would hope that they are resolved. But I think we have to also keep in mind that Egypt is will be an entirely different country an entirely different government. Once you have a new president elected, so you'll have a president, you'll have a parliament that's dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, and you'll have a cabinet in which the Muslim Brotherhood plays a quite major role. Under these circumstances, it's just not clear what kind of aid the United States should be giving, whether it should be giving aid at all, what the priorities of this new Egyptian government will be. So I would say that it's just not clear right now.
Any second thoughts about the backstage U.S. pressure on the military to end Mubarak's rule, given what's happened since?
Absolutely not. If the United States had maintained no role whatsoever in Egypt, had played no role, things would have still evolved in the way that they have evolved. Mubarak's time had ended. The United States was actually rather late in the game in pressuring him to leave. But if we had not pressured him to leave, if we had tried to support him, or if we had taken some kind of neutral, non-involved position, the results still would have been the same. He would have left.
Well, talking about non-intervention or intervention, that leads us to Syria, where the United Nations estimates that more than 5,000 have been killed since March 2011, 12,000 taking refuge across the border in Turkey. With Russia and China blocking a UN Security Council resolution, there's talk about other forms of intervention, notably arming up army defectors now battling the regime of Bashar al-Assad. What's your view on that?
I would hope the United States would work hand-in-hand with Turkey and Europe and other possible allies, allies in the Arab world as well, to develop a strategy in which all of these forces agree and are involved. I think part of that strategy should be to try to deepen the diplomatic and economic pressure on the Assad regime through sanctions, through various economic measures, and through diplomatic isolation. If it goes beyond that, I would hope that the United States, Turkey, Arab countries would develop some kind of a united strategy to perhaps help the opposition there.
What's the logic that permitted intervention to protect civilians in Libya but not Syria?
Well, I think in part the logic is that Libya was a relatively easy venue for intervention. The Gaddafi government was weak. It was unraveling rather quickly, and we, through NATO, could involve ourselves with minimal threat that there would be some kind of terrible price for us to pay. And that's not the case in Syria. Syria has a real army. We would be involved in yet another a shooting war in the Middle East, and I think it would not be supported by the American people, and it would probably be a mistake.
Arch Puddington is vice president for research at Freedom House, whose democracy workers are under threat of prosecution in Egypt.
This quote from the news: "We're destroying Libya with our bare hands." That was a Libyan militia commander dismayed as rival groups stripped a captured base of weapons in the increasing clash of armed forces that Libya's new government is unable to control.
Next, new views on leadership for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. "I think we all do better in committed relationships." That was Washington State Senator Jim Castama on reversing his earlier opposition and voting in favor of a same-sex marriage bill that Governor Christine Gregoire promised to sign within days, joining 10 other states with similar laws. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court in California ruled Proposition 8 there, banning gay marriage, was unconstitutional, moving the issue closer to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now this.
We learn to be good listeners. Some great thought leader has said, Peter Drucker, think first, speak last. but we learn the art of listening.
Leadership is not what it was or was thought to be, at least as celebrated by Oscar Hammerstein and Jerome Kern in Stout-Hearted Men from the New Moon, a classic film of rebellion in French New Orleans. The best in contemporary leadership, sensitive, inclusive, cooperative, many other leaders agree, is exemplified by Frances Hesselbein, a former local Girl Scout leader in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. She quickly became national head of that distinguished, dynamic, and beloved organization, also a disciple of management guru Peter Drucker, then head of the Drucker Foundation for Nonprofit Management, now reconstituted as the Frances Hesselbein Leadership Institute. She also has a chair in leadership at West Point and speaks endlessly to corporate, college, government, and nonprofit groups across the country and around the world.
Hesselbein's recent memoir is My Life in Leadership, The Journey and Lessons Learned Along the Way from Jossie Bass Wiley Publishers. And to talk about that journey, those lessons, and the changing nature of leadership in our Internet age, for your ears only, Frances Hesselbein is on the line now. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. I'm honored to be with you.
And we're honored to have you. You were the young mother of an 8-year-old boy when you agreed to fill in for a Girl Scout troop leader who'd left for missionary work. What made you say yes?
They were going to have to disband the troop. I couldn't bear the thought of 30-year-old girls losing their Girl Scout troop, even though I knew nothing about Girl Scouting.
What was the most important leadership lesson you learned at that grassroots level at the beginning, heading the local Girl Scout Council then and the local United Way?
The power of mission. When we all understand why we do what we do, our mission is our reason for being. And when we're faithful to that mission, it is very, very powerful. I think wherever we are, whatever we do, we have to be mission-focused, values-based, demographics-driven.
What led you to the works of the late Peter Drucker, and what are his key principles?
Long, long ago, I had discovered Peter Drucker's books, The Effective Executive, one of the greatest ones. I had no idea who Peter Drucker was. You know, I'm in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, but I loved his philosophy. I loved his work, and I had every book he had ever written. And a few years later, when I became the executive director of the local Girl Scout Council, as I walked into the office, under my arm I had Peter Drucker's The Effective Executive. Peter distilled the philosophy of leadership and management. Other people would take 3 paragraphs. Peter would say, think first, speak last. And he had this wonderful wisdom. And to this day, I think he is our greatest thought leader. And we made sure that his books moved around the country and around the world, and that was the purpose of the Drucker Foundation, which was founded 6 weeks after I left my 13 years with Girl Scouts of the USA.
You say a leader is simply someone with followers, but you also stress that today's technology, economic pressures, ideological diversity makes leadership more difficult at many levels. House Speaker John Boehner sure can't count on traditional party discipline anymore.
If you focus on the mission, and as you began, before you began, you said, these are my values, whatever they were, respect for all people, for example. You live your values. And then every day you learn. Leadership is an adventure in learning. And when we see all of the new technology, we don't say, oh, it's so formidable. No, we say, what marvelous opportunity, and we make it our own.
Talk about the mission of the Frances Hesselbein Leadership Institute.
We learned from Peter, your mission should fit on a T-shirt. And so our mission is to support, to help the leaders of the social sector and their partners in business and government. And this is what Peter Drucker taught us. And he also used to say, it is not business. It is not government. It is the social sector that may yet save the society.
And by the social sector, you mean largely nonprofits. You say a new generation of young adults in America seems to have community concerns and commitment to service built into its DNA, which gives you hope and energy.
Oh, enormous hope. And it's not just what I've been experiencing on the ground on campuses at the military academies, but this generation, they call the millennials, and Warren Bennis calls the crucible generation. There is now a Pew study which affirms there's something about this generation now on university campuses, military academies, that is more like the generation of the 30s and 40s that we now call the greatest generation. It gives me energy.
Frances Hesselbein has won the Presidential Medal of Freedom and been named the best nonprofit manager in America by Fortune magazine. She is CEO of the Frances Hesselbein Leadership Institute, formerly the Drucker Foundation for Nonprofit Management, and holds a special chair in leadership at West Point. Her memoir is My Life in Leadership, The Journey and Lessons Learned Along the Way, from Jossie Bass Wiley Publishers. Next, Regards to Broadway, a CD of old songs from a new song and dance man, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Mind if I join you? That was President John F. Kennedy's Come On line, according to Mimi Alford in her memoir Once Upon a Secret, recalling her days as a 19-year-old White House intern having an extramarital affair with Kennedy, though she says she was, quote, merely occupying the president's time while his wife was away. Now this.
Give my regards to Broadway. Remember me to Herald Square. Tell all the gang at 42nd Street that I will soon be there.
Broadway musical veteran Joel Grey joins rising star Robert Creighton in an apt song for both of them by George M. Cohan from Creighton's debut CD, Ain't We Got Fun, released this week by LML Music. Creighton plays the purser in Broadway's current revival of Cole Porter's Anything Goes and understudies Gray's leading role as Moonface Martin.
Most all the selections on the new CD are from bygone eras that Creighton has long loved and recently learned more about doing research for his one-man show, Cagney, about the Hollywood tough guy who also played Cohan on the black and white silver screen. And to talk about that show, the other songs, and his own career for your ears only, Robert Creighton joins us now. Welcome to our show.
Great to be with you.
So how did a kid from Ontario, Canada get interested in Broadway shows?
Well, you're right. I'm from a very small town called Walkerton, which is about 2 hours northwest of Toronto, and not very close to Broadway in any way, shape, or form. But I had parents who were really keen on exposing us to that, and I was the youngest of six kids, and a couple times a year we would go down to the big city of Toronto and see shows that were touring through there. In those days, there were a lot of shows produced in Toronto, and fell in love right away. And my first real love was the old movie musicals. When I was a kid, I had two dreams. One was to be a goalie in the NHL, and the other was to be Fred Astaire. Neither of those is really possible based on skill level as a goalie and based on what I look like as a person, but is Fred Astaire. Inside, I'm Fred Astaire, but externally, I don't look like that at all.
And what shows have you been in on Broadway and around the country?
It took me a while. I was 10 years out of acting school and worked a lot, thankfully, around in regional theaters, a lot of shows at Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey, and lead roles at Goodspeed and different things like that. And I did two seasons with New York City Opera and Lion King in Toronto and L.A. And then finally, in 2003, I made my Broadway debut in a short run of a show called Laughing Room Only with Jackie Mason. It was his sort of attempt at a musical that lasted 4 weeks of previews and 2 weeks of a run. Yeah, the poster's in Joe Allen's as we speak with all the other flocks. But then since then, I sort of broke the seal there, and I'm now in my sixth Broadway show. I've played Amos in Chicago on Broadway, which is another Joel Grey connection, currently playing The Purse or Anything Goes, and Timon and Lion King, and Chef Louis and The Little Mermaid. I've had some good fortune on Broadway since I got started.
What led you to the musical career of screen tough guy Jimmy Cagney?
When I was in acting school, I had a teacher who said to me, "You remind me of Jimmy Cagney, and I'm built like him. I tap dance like him." And I only knew sort of Yankee Doodle Dandy at that time, and I started watching his films. You know, at that point, I'm thinking so much about my craft as an actor and that sort of thing, and was so amazed by him as an actor. You just couldn't take your eyes off of him. And then I watched all these movies, and then I started reading about who he was as a man, as a person, and just his humanitarianism and everything that he did, and stuck up for the little guy. And it became my dream at one point to sort of bring his story to the stage, and that's what's happened now.
How much of a musical career did Cagney have aside from Yankee Doodle Dandy? What other songs was he known for?
Yankee Doodle Dandy, of course, was the George Cohan biopic.
Yeah, he won his Oscar for playing George M. Cohan in 1942. One of his only Oscar. He probably should have won three or four more, in my opinion. Got robbed a few times. There are several... in the early stages, when he became famous as a gangster, Jack Warner in particular, was reluctant to let him do musicals, even though that he came from a vaudeville world. And he did a few. He did Shanghai Lil. You might remember that's one of his famous songs from Footlight Parade and the West Point Story. He had a few other musicals that he was known for. But, of course, he is known as the quintessential gangster. And really that's one of the themes of our shows, him coming to grips with the fact that he wanted to be known as a song and dance man, but he was... In the public eye, he was this quintessential, tough guy that didn't reflect who he was as a person at all.
But your debut CD only has two Cagney songs. Let's look at some of the others, why you chose them, some of the guest artists, starting with Joel Grey. Remind listeners of his extraordinary career up to now.
Well, Joel Grey, first of all, it's just a complete honor that he agreed to sing on my CD. I mean, he is a legend in the theater. He's one of the few people who has an Oscar and a Tony for playing the same role in Cabaret. Played the MC in Cabaret, has originated so many memorable roles, including George M. on Broadway, and now playing Moonface in our show. He just it charms the audience every night. And so when he agreed to sing a Cohan song with me on my album, it just was a moment that I'll have forever that I was so grateful for.
Another track combines Accentuate the Positive with another take on the same theme, Look for the Silver Lining, our second Jerome Kern song on this program. Why those two, and why Titus Burgess as guest vocalist?
Well, yeah, easy answer on Titus Burgess. I just think he's one of the most remarkable, has one of the most remarkable instruments in anywhere that I've heard, singing-wise. He also is a guy who I got to know and become friends with during Little Mermaid, and those two songs. First of all, Accentuate the Positive was a song I sang since I can remember. It was my dad's favorite song. It's also his outlook on life and passed that on to me. And I had the idea of combining those two songs with the same sentiment. And then Georgia Stitt, who did most of the arrangements and produced my album, she figured out the math of how to put those two songs together. I just had the idea of combining them because I liked what they say. And it was also, one of my favorite songs of the era. And then she sort of figured out how that would happen in that track.
The very first track on the CD is called Dad's Medley. Talk about those two songs and the connection with your dad.
Yeah, 5'2" and Ain't She Sweet. And it's fun. This weekend I'm having two CD release concerts in New York, and I was just thinking about what I would say to intro that song. And I vividly remember when I was 4 or 5 years old, there was this phase where people would go, instead of going jogging, they'd just get dressed up and run on the spot in their home, you know, and I would sit there and sing for my dad while he did this. My dad really was such a fan, and my mom and dad were such beautiful dancers together. We put on Glenn Miller, and they were just like butter. I'm the youngest of six kids, and we learned to dance in our living room, and just had such a love of that music in our household that I wanted to pay tribute to my dad for really introducing me to that and instilling that, that love for this great music.
Robert Creighton appears in the current Broadway revival of Anything Goes. His new CD of old songs is Ain't We Got Fun from LML Music, whose title track ends this way.
In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Next, the Olympics' first black gold for your ears only. A little more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. My husband cannot bleep and throw the ball and catch the ball at the same time. That was supermodel Gisele Bündchen on the number of passes thrown by her husband, the New England Patriots' Tom Brady, and dropped by his teammates at the Super Bowl, losing to the New York Giants 21-17. Now this.
The 2012 London Summer Olympic Games are approaching, and as we continue to celebrate Black History Month, it's fitting to revisit a previous London Olympics, specifically the Summer Games of 1908, when John Baxter Taylor Jr. became the first African-American to win Olympic gold.
Dr. Taylor was born in Washington, D.C. in 1882 and died of typhoid in Philadelphia in 1908 at the age of 26. In his short life, he pushed against the barriers of bigotry and prejudice, accomplishing what few others had, not only taking track and field gold, but also earning a degree in veterinary medicine. With more of Taylor's achievements and untimely end for your ears only, we have author Craig Williams, who tells the story in his historical novel, The Olympian, An American Triumph. Welcome to our program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. First, tell us when you learned about Taylor and why you chose to write about him.
I stumbled across his story somewhat accidentally. I was reintroduced to that period of history by way of one of his contemporaries, the first African-American heavyweight boxing champion, Jack Johnson. And after digesting his story and appreciating the significance of his journey, I was curious to know what other pioneers, particularly African-American pioneers, were doing things at that time. And when I stumbled across Dr. Taylor's story, I was just blown away that I had never heard of him before and thought that others might be interested in his story as well.
Put Taylor's story in context for us. In a time not that long after emancipation, but considerably before the Civil Rights Movement, what was it like for African-Americans of the period?
This is a moment in American history when Black people were no longer slaves, but were not quite free. It was kind of an in-between period when mainstream society was trying to figure out how it was going to handle and respond to this new population of free African Americans. But largely, people of color were still displaced in society with very few avenues to enter the workforce, and to pursue other opportunities that the society had to offer. And so Dr. Taylor's story is all the more remarkable because the things that he accomplished outside of the arena of sports are as impressive as the things he did as an athlete.
Well, tell us about some of the barriers he had to overcome growing up in veterinarian school, making the team.
Well, this is an individual whose parents were born slaves. And as mentioned just a moment ago, mainstream society really did deal with people of color as something less than second-class citizens. So at every turn, he would have experienced the low expectations and or closed doors of society. But despite that, his parents were able to establish a middle-class lifestyle for their family. The father was described as an entrepreneur. I portray him as a caterer, that being a business that people of color did manage to excel in at that time. And he was able to attend a prestigious high school, Central High, which still exists today and has a very strong academic tradition. And from there, he went to the University of Pennsylvania, where he ultimately received his doctorate as a doctor of veterinary medicine. But clearly, everywhere that he went, he would have had to figure out how to overcome those individuals who would rather have not seen him participating.
How was he treated at the 1908 Games by American teammates and all of the foreigners there?
You know, all of the accounts are that he was treated reasonably well. You know, acts of discrimination and rejection are very rarely recorded. I mean, there's some evidence that his race was an issue of some kind, but for the most part, there's very little documentation that would suggest that he was directly discriminated against. although a huge controversy erupted in the finals of the 400-meter race, the controversy was not centered around him, but there is some evidence that would suggest that, that his race played an interesting role in how he was received.
How did Taylor see his accomplishment and its fallout for other African Americans?
I think he certainly appreciated that he was blazing a trail. I think that that was an element that characterized pretty much everything he did throughout his life. There wasn't a specific quote of him talking about its significance for the African-American community, but he, along with a delegation of the Olympic team, was invited to Teddy Roosevelt's summer home in Long Island, and he was personally congratulated by the President of the United States upon their return from the Olympics. So I'm sure he appreciated that, as Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president at the time, was also the first president to welcome an African-American to the White House, that being Booker T. Washington. So, you know, that type of a recognition from the leader of the free world was certainly meaningful.
Craig Williams is the author of The Olympian, An American Triumph, the untold story of the first African-American Olympic gold medalist, from Vintage World Publishing. And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. The world's digital bank. That's the Citigroup motto that suffered a major setback with disclosure of a flaw in the bank's new iPad bill pay app that has been double-charging customers. The bank has promised to refund any lost fees or interest incurred.
For Your Ears Only, On Air is online at YouTube, iTunes, and Podcast Bunker. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donation. Please email davideearsonly@gmail.com to pledge.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly with interns Gene Moon and Rachel Murray. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern, acknowledging support from the nonprofit Gatewave Radio Reading Service, the century-old Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Rachel Murray. This week last year was dominated by the ouster of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, and we played a bit of our coverage earlier in this program. But another story from last year's show also touched on a current hot topic, breast cancer. The science, though, not the politics. The Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation, or Planned Parenthood Connection. From our February 13th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by Melissa and David.
An axillary lymph node dissection, where you remove most, if not all, of the lymph nodes under the arm, has complications like shoulder pain, limitation of motion, and the most dreaded complication is the lymphedema, the swollen arm. I think the bottom line is that many women who are treated with the more radical axillary lymph node dissection don't need it.
As if breast cancer itself weren't bad enough, a new study finds that a significant number of those treated for the disease have been undergoing an unnecessary, painful, and potentially complicating follow-up procedure, removal of lymph nodes under the armpit. The procedure's been standard medical practice for 100 years, but it doesn't significantly improve outcomes, as we heard from an AP interview with Dr. Armando Giuliano, a researcher at the John Wayne Cancer Institute and lead author of this study, which may prompt a change in treatment for some 40,000 patients a year in the U.S. if they're comfortable with doing less.
Since research has found breast cancer can begin to spread early, even when tumors are small, doctors have believed that cutting out even microscopic disease in the lymph nodes will increase the odds of survival. But the new studies say for women who meet certain criteria, removal of the cancerous lymph nodes is unnecessary because their chemotherapy and radiation likely wipe out disease in the nodes. The new view may be seen as part of a trend towards minimizing surgery for breast cancer, which heartens some patients but makes others nervous. With us today to talk about the implications of the study, for your ears only, is Fran Visco, president of the National Breast Cancer Coalition, the NBCC, a grassroots and advocacy group now dedicated to ending breast cancer by the year 2020. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
The study finds women who had nodes removed were far more likely to suffer complications, 70% versus 25% for those who don't have it. How serious are those side effects?
Well, those side effects can be very debilitating, especially lymphedema. They can stop a woman from doing her job. You know, they can affect her in many ways. It is not a simple, you know, I have pain in my arm. These are really significant quality of life issues.
Explain what specific group of cancer patients fall into the group that this study says could be excluded from lymph node removal.
Well, this study looked at a subgroup of women, which make up about 40,000 women a year with breast cancer, and it is women who have small tumors, 1 or 2 centimeters, who have micrometastasis in 1 or 2 of their lymph nodes from sentinel node biopsy, who have had a lumpectomy, adjuvant chemotherapy or hormone therapy, and whole breast radiation. So you have to be very careful when you look at which population this study looked at.
Over the last few decades, less radical treatment of breast cancer has been recommended. Rates of mastectomy have declined since studies found lumpectomy and radiation worked just as well for some patients. Is this another case of less is more?
Yes, absolutely. That's what the science is telling us. It's unfortunate that, you know, many women and physicians don't accept less is more. I hear women many times saying, give me everything you've got and give me as much as you can because I want to get rid of this. And what they don't understand is that there are benefits, but there are risks. And in many situations, when you do more rather than less based on science, you end up with more of the risk and fewer of the benefits.
In our new era of financial restraint and health care reform, many people are also pretty sensitive about what may appear to be health care rationing. Do you see that as a factor affecting the lymph node study?
I think this was a very well-designed study that asked an important question that followed up on the initial sentinel node biopsy studies. And this is the result. We either believe in science or we don't. Sometimes science is going to tell us an intervention that costs less is equally or more effective. Sometimes the opposite will be true. It is not about the cost. It's about harm to women and benefit to women.
And the NBCC has previously supported a science-based decision to limit treatment when the Food and Drug Administration moved against the use of the breast cancer drug Avastin. Talk about that.
Well, we were very concerned with the studies and the study results on Avastin because it did not show a benefit in overall survival, but it did show significant risks. You really have to look at the benefit and the harm. So the benefit was not there. The benefit that existed was tumors didn't grow as quickly in a certain number of women, but that had no effect on survival and no effect on quality of life. But the harms were significant. There were deaths, there was heart disease. So it's not just a new drug or a new theory. It may be exciting, but we need to look at the science and rely on the science.
As you've noted, doctors themselves can be a hurdle, favoring procedures they're used to, calling the failure to remove all traces of cancer unethical, and probably certain insurance concerns as well. But some prominent institutions that wouldn't take part in the study are very supportive now. Talk about that if you think that will make it an easier sell to doctors and patients, or is it going to take more studies or years of statistics on survival rates?
Now, in this situation, I do not believe it's going to take many more years or looking at long-term survival rates. You know, this is not, again, we're not talking about something that there's a better overall survivor or worse. It is the same, and it is significant less risk and less harm to women. So I think in that case, now that we have the science, I think more and more physicians will take this up. I think they were concerned about it when we did not have the science.
The NBCC has made it a mission to end breast cancer by January 1st, 2020, with a rundown clock on your new website, breastcancerdeadline2020.org. Why that date, and how are you working to reach it?
Well, we have a strategic plan on how to achieve it, and we looked at where we are in science, where we are in technology, you know, how much we have learned about the biology of the disease, and we believe that 10 years is the right number. We have to set a deadline, otherwise the scientific community will continue doing what they have been doing and will have incremental benefit and some harm, but we need leaps. We need to figure out how to stop deaths and prevent breast cancer from developing. And this lymph node study, by the way, does not answer any of those questions.
Fran Visco is president of the National Breast Cancer Coalition at breastcancerdeadline2020.org.
Breast cancer, when less is more, from our February 13th, 2011 broadcast. A study issued last week indicated that while whole foods rich in soy lower risk for breast cancer, soy dietary supplements do not, and may even increase it. And a study at the Toronto University Health Network found that a majority of postmenopausal women at high risk for breast cancer are not taking advantage of the generic estrogen-suppressing drug, aromasin, previously shown to decrease risk of the disease by 65%, although also increasing bone density loss. I'm Rachel Murray. We'll visit the archive again next week.